We've been discussing the proper perspective on understanding Prabhupada's statements about women. And what we've discovered in our reading, in our discussion, is that in Vedic culture, women were always protected but highly respected, and they were protected because they were respected. And in the Shastra it says that women should always be protected, just as elderly people should be protected, just as cows should be protected, just as children should be protected, and just as brahmanas should be protected. So these persons are considered respectful to persons to be respected, and they're considered superiors. And therefore, they're given protection. And we discovered in our discussions that the reason Prabhupada says women should be protected is to protect the chastity of society so that children are not born out of wedlock. And our children are only born because they're wanted. And not only that, they're born after performing samskaras, which means that parents will attract a higher caliber of children, which means that society will be more elevated and more peaceful. Now, since we had our last discussion, I came across some figures. In 1960, hospitals report that of all the children born in hospitals, or the reporting hospitals, 5% were born out of wedlock. In other words, the parents who had the children were not married. They may have been living together or not living together. Now, as I think in 2005 or so, that figure has changed to 30%. Now 30% of the children are being born out of wedlock. And Prabhupada criticized this because marriage is an ashram. It's an ashram in which one takes responsibility for children, for the spouse. And if children are born out of wedlock, there's greater chance that it will end up in divorce. So when we talk about women needing protection, really they're being protected in the sense that we're protecting the entire family. Because in Vedic culture, it's interesting that women, when they're very young, generally when they were very young, a husband was picked out for them. And Prabhupada said, in that way they didn't have to. They wouldn't have boyfriends, and there wouldn't be any illicit connection with men. And they were peaceful, knowing that they had their husband. And then when they became of age, then they would get married. But before that, they knew, this is my husband. So that was the culture. And in that culture, women also understood the psychology of men, and that men like to be in charge. And so the women never try to outdo their husband or be better than their husbands. And that's why we get this, we always hear about women should be subordinate to their husband. But another reason was that generally the men, or many of the men in the higher classes, were trained. So trained in Vedic knowledge. And so they became the guru to the wife because there was no schooling for women in Vedic knowledge. So that was another reason they were respected. Excuse me, that they respected their husbands. And, you know, of course, nowadays, we're trying to make everything equal. And the point of the article we're reading is that women naturally don't really want to be equal to men. They don't want to try to compete with them. They'd rather be protected, but when men are not protecting them, then they become independent and they fend for themselves. So that's an unnatural situation. But the whole basis of what we're talking here is really about protecting the chastity of women and chastity within society. And in Prabhupada's teachings, he talks a lot about the whole Vedic system, Varnashram system, and the Vedic teachings and all that is all ultimately geared to reducing sex desire and ultimately reducing it to nil. And he makes the point that in the Varnashram system, there are four ashrams, but sex is only allowed in three. And in the one ashram in which it's allowed, it's only allowed in a restricted way. And how in Vedic times men and women did not mingle closely. So the social system was set up to protect illicit connection between men and women. We also discussed how there were prostitutes, and the reason there were prostitutes was so that innocent virgin women would not be polluted by men who could not control themselves. But there were women who actually had the profession of prostitutes. So rather than trying to pick up good women who could be good wives, or who already are wives, there were prostitutes. And men who could not control themselves would see those prostitutes. So now I'm going to continue reading. And I think it'll be a little more clear. I'm going to read a few paragraphs that we read last time, just to refresh where we're coming from, and then we'll discuss this. The Vedic literature is filled with stories of great women who, on account of their loyalty to Dharma, attain the perfection of self-fulfillment. And here, when we're talking loyalty to Dharma, it means their womanly duties, to be the loyal wife, to take a more or less of a subordinate role to their husband, and to do duties which were in that social system assigned to women, not trying to compete with men. Gandhari, who blindfolded herself so as not to surpass her blind husband. Kunti Devi, who preached to her husband to abide by the Vedic injunctions and composed her famous prayers. Damayanti, who saved her husband Nala from a life of sin. Savitri, who thoughtfully released her husband Satyavan from the hands of Yamaraj, the god of death. And there are many other examples. There are also women who were great spiritual teachers and great composers, like the South Indian Andal Mirabai, Janavi Devi of Bengal, and so on. In fact, when the Vedic scriptures discuss the need to protect women, the intention is specifically in regard to protection from the sexual energy or sexual environment, which corrupts the feminine qualities and the entire society. So we were talking a lot about women naturally are shy, that's their nature, but in our society now, the whole thing is show off your body and be sexually attractive and seductive. And that's not really, if you just leave women to their own devices, that's not really how they would end up. But our society is socializing women to be, quote-unquote, sexy. And men understand what sexy means. I don't know if women totally understand what it means. If they did, some of them at least would have second thoughts about being too sexy. But really, when we're talking about women being sexy, what it means is it makes men think of sex, particularly with them. If a woman is sexy, when a man sees her, he thinks, oh, I'd like to have sex with her. So women, if you want every man on the street to think about having sex with you, then just dress like a sexy babe, and that's what they're going to be thinking. They say they've done tests with men, and they say men have sexual thoughts every 20 seconds. So you don't even have to dress that scantily to arouse their sexual thought. And this one teenage boy said to his father, when his father said, you know, men have sexual thoughts every 20 seconds. He said, well, what am I supposed to think the other 19 seconds? Like, I don't know what else to think about because that's all I think about. So there's this whole world of six-pack abs and, you know, tight buns and this, and how do you look in the tight jeans? And this is just like, it's insane. It's insanity. And it's not making anybody happy. It's driving people crazy. So everybody's trying to look sexy. So for a Krishna conscious woman, obviously she doesn't want men to be looking at her and thinking about sex. She wants men to be thinking about Krishna. So she behaves and dresses appropriately. And that's why in Vedic societies we discuss when the women dress up, they dress up for their husbands. They don't dress up for other men in general. In our society, women go out, they I don't know how they look at home, but when they go out, they deck themselves out. They may not look so well at home. In Vedic society, it was the other way around. When the women would go out, they wouldn't, generally, unless it was some festival, really dress up. They're not trying to attract men. But they would dress up for their husband at home to be attractive to him. So that sexual energy remained at home where it was safe, where it could be productive. So let's continue reading. In fact, when the Vedic scriptures discuss the need to protect women, the intention is specifically in regard to protection from the sexual energy or sexual environment, which corrupts the feminine qualities and the entire society. This kind of protection is only possible when society holds motherhood to be the highest expression of feminism, and women as a whole are seen as mothers. So in Vedic culture, women are addressed as mothers, and the children, when they get up in the morning, they touch the feet of their mother. So we have Yash with us and Catherine with us. Now, I just want to make a disclaimer here that all of you out there do not have to agree with what I'm saying or what we're reading, and you're welcome to discuss it. We're just reading and discussing, and these are, these can be sensitive issues, and certainly subject to interpretation and adaptation within our present culture. But one of the things we are understanding here is when we hear statements that Srila Prabhupada makes about women and about how women and men relate, if we understand the culture in which it was born, the value of that culture, and the philosophical foundations of the culture, it helps us better understand the context in which those statements were made and the cultures and how the cultures function that follows that followed those principles, and how the women were happy and not exploited. Indeed, in the Vedic culture, men were educated to see every woman except for their wife as a mother, mataji. That means that she is not a sexual object for their pleasure, but an object of respect. The protection of the father, husband, and son is not meant to lock her at home and hide her from the world, but to implant in her a sense of security and belonging. Also, what it does for the men is it sends a message to the men that this woman belongs to her father, and you have to be qualified if you want to marry her, and you have to take care of her as well as her father took care of her. And it sends a message to the sons that if the father ever leaves or dies, that we take care of our mother. So men grow up in a culture in which women are always taken care of. And in our culture, not all men think that way, but men think, I don't want to say primarily, but they think on a certain fundamental level, although they may think, yes, women need protection and so on, but they see women as objects of sexual gratification. And that's why women are used in advertising, because, as they say, sex sells. And we've trained up men in such a way that they're so easily disturbed by the beautiful form of a woman. And therefore, in advertising, these beautiful women are everywhere. And so men are seeing all these beautiful women not very well dressed. And they're not able to see them as mother, but they're seeing them as objects of their sexual gratification. So they begin to relate with women, their girlfriends, as objects of sexual gratification. They begin to see their wives that way. They begin to see the wives of other men that way. So it becomes an incredible problem. So in Vedic society, women were protected. So naturally, because they were protected, men didn't have access to them. And there was less of a tendency to see them as sexual objects because they had no access to them anyway. In our society, we have a lot of access to the opposite sex. We even have access to the opposite sex who are married. It's very common, in the workplace especially, for people to become attached to one another who are married. And so, you know, women want to be out in the workplace. They want to be, you know, they want to become presidents and start their own companies and CEOs and so forth. But there's also a problem. There's this very close mingling of men and women. So we have to understand the other side of it. You know, in the Vedic culture, it really protected that. So it's not that women weren't necessarily good at doing certain things, or weren't necessarily even better than men at doing certain things, or better than some men at doing certain things. But to bring them into a workforce where they so closely work with and associate with the opposite sex is not healthy. And that's what we have. That's what we have in our society. And therefore, now there's all kinds of rules in companies about sexual harassment. Like if a woman doesn't dress properly, that would be considered sexual harassment in the workplace. So you didn't really have that in Vedic society because women were protected. The protection of the father, husband, and son is not meant to lock her at home and hide her from the world, but to implant in her a sense of security and belonging, which she requires as Prakriti. In other words, she wants that. If she needs that, that's how she's happy. For her different occupations and contacts with the world. In any case, when a woman is not defined through a connection with a man, she is prone to anxiety. And in her attempts to attain the security of a Purusha, which means the male ego or the male mentality, she is forced to appeal to her lower nature, the sexual and seductive. So what we've been basically talking about is she has two natures. One nature is to be protected, to be happy in that situation, to be happy with one man. And the other nature, when that's not there, is the seductive side, the strongly sexual side, and try to attract men sexually. And here, in this article, it's being said she's forced to act that way when she's not properly protected. And in our society, that in many ways, that's how women feel their worth, and rightly so, because that's how men are judging them. So we have this social situation going on where women are being evaluated on how beautiful and how sexy they are. And so they feel that that's how they'll, that part of their self-worth is being determined by their sexuality. So that's a lot different than the Vedic conception. Now we have a word on men from our sponsor. Okay, Bhakti, let's read something. Writer Krishna Devi Dasi is asking, so how do we in Kali Yuga and Western society deal with the fact that we are not protected, that our fathers and brothers aren't protecting us? How do we work around that? So it's a very good question. And first thing I would say is that we don't want to oscillate to the other side. And naturally, you have to protect yourself to a certain degree if you're not being protected. But you don't want to oscillate to the side that's being described in this article, where you try to become like a man. And I think it's good to recognize, for women to recognize that they do have that nature, that they want to be protected, and that they really don't want to be men, and they really don't want to go strutting around trying to sexually attract men. So, obviously, in this society where women are not always protected, then they have to take care of themselves to some degree. So I think a lot of it we may be dealing here with maintaining the proper mentality, even if externally you have to fend for yourself, so to speak. If there aren't men who are capable of taking care of you, but not to in any way degrade yourself because of that, or lose your feminine nature or side because of that. And then also, you can be open to the fact that there are men who can make good husbands, who are there to protect you, and Krishna can help you find them if you're open to that, if that's what you need. And also, Prabhupada said to women, if they want, they can remain unmarried, although generally that is difficult for most women. But he said, you can make Krishna your husband if that's what you want. But never, he never recommended them taking on the male ego. I don't know if that answers your question. You can ask more if it doesn't. I didn't really get into details there. But sometimes, you know, you have to take your protection into your own hands. Sometimes men are physically abuse their wives. That's a very difficult situation for them, and they have to take matters into their own hands. In regards to, Bhakti Karel is asking, in regards to women being submissive, does this extend to submitting to physical relations, expectations of the husband, when this goes against the regulative principles? She's saying, you're married, your husband wants to have sex, you've taken a vow not to, what do you do? There are two possible ways of looking at it. I think ultimately you have to base it on what the ultimate result will be. You know, is your husband going to, is this going to actually in the long run help him? Do you have the mentality or you have the consciousness within you that you could break a principle in order to help your husband? Even does that even make sense to you to break a principle if it will help your husband? Or maybe your husband needs help and you need to help him so he doesn't want these things. Of course, for a husband, it is said that the wife is his protection. So the wife is, you know, the place where he can satisfy himself sexually. And so rather than fall down, as we say, or as a polite way of saying, have illicit connection with another woman, he needs to be satisfied by his wife. But in Krishna consciousness, we're taking vows to remain celibate. So it's kind of a fine line because a woman might say, well, if I don't do this, my husband will leave me. And I'm married and I have kids. So we have to look at the situation a little more carefully and in a one-on-one basis. You know, generally the answer is, we could say strictly, say, no, you don't have to. You're not required to do that. In fact, if your husband wants that, you're not even required to remain his wife. You could take it to that degree if you wanted. Or you could take it to the other degree and say, well, he's not very advanced and he needs this. But generally I find that women who have made their vows to be celibate find it extremely difficult to give up their vows to satisfy their husband and rather prefer to help him deal with his own issues so that they both can go on in Krishna consciousness. It works the other way around also. Women may want it and husbands don't. So it can be the cause of a lot of marital problems. So we have to analyze, well, what's more important? Or how can we deal with this? And it's not as simple as I wish it were. And of course I didn't give you a yes or no answer, because strictly speaking, as an official policy, the only answer I could give you would be no. But that's not always the answer that's always given. So you have to see the exact situation and what's involved. And look at things in the broader perspective and see what will be the best in the long run. In the beginning of the movement, the devotees didn't know what illicit sex was. So there was an initiation, and so Prabhupada explained what the principles were. Maybe it was the first initiation, so then one of the devotees who was higher grievous, he said, well, what is illicit sex? And Prabhupada said, sex only in marriage to have children. So Hayagriva thought for a minute, and he realized, well, if you're only having sex to have children, you're practically not having it. And he thought, well, if you're practically not having it, it seems better not to have it at all. I mean, you're just going to have a little bit of it. Why even have it at all? And Prabhupada said, well, that's the point. The point is to become detached from it ultimately. So that's the idea. So when one of the spouses is not satisfied sexually, we don't want to end up in destroying the marriage, and at the same time we don't want to excite the sexual passion, because the whole idea is we're coming together to ultimately fulfill that desire and then become detached from it. So yeah, Radhika's asking what's going on here. I wish I knew what was going on, Radhika. This is like this is such a difficult subject to speak about, because we live in a society which is so alien from the philosophy and culture which we are trying to adopt and practice, or we may not even be trying to adopt it that much, but we're trying to live it philosophically and understand it philosophically. And then how we deal with women who are not raised in a culture in which men highly respect them and they highly respect men, but they're raised in a culture where men don't respect them. They see them as sexual objects. They try to take advantage of them. They exploit them. They get them pregnant. And then here Prabhupada's saying to the women, well, you should be under the care of a man. And the women are saying, what man? And Prabhupada's saying women are less intelligent, and we see that most of the men in the world are not devotees, so they're all fools. So how is it that they're more intelligent than the women? And, you know, we're trying to understand all these things. And the role of men and women, and how men and women should and should not associate in Krishna consciousness. What are the parameters of it? And the position in the social system. So Radha Krishna Devi Dasi is asking, or saying, I agree with your statements, but I suppose I'm thinking in a practical sense, how do we as a society educate both our men and women properly? As I said, I think one of the problems, if not the fundamental problem, is that we're not raised this way. So I think it's important for us to see the philosophy in the context of the culture in which the philosophy was lived, because it becomes easier to understand it, and when we take it out of that context, often it doesn't totally make sense. At the same time, we have to understand the principles so we can know how we want to apply those principles in our current society. In current society, men and women are not separated at all. They're everywhere. They intermingle. So Prabhupada acknowledged that, and he said, you can't separate men and women, and it's artificial. But what he basically warned us against is unmarried men and unmarried women, or married men and women who are not married being alone together or intimately working together or spending extended periods of time together. And what he wanted from us was to create either renunciates who were strong enough to remain celibate and not married, or married couples who were strong enough to remain together and be chaste to one another. And so that's really the essence. That's really the basis of it. And so, you know, and we can say, well, in, you know, Vedic culture, generally the women were submissive to the husband. They did what he said, even when they disagreed. And that's not how women are trained. It's not the role models they grow up seeing. And it's often difficult for them to be that way, or to be that way to the degree that perhaps their husband would want them to be, or to be that way to the degree that women were in Vedic culture. So then we have to look and say, well, what makes sense today for a married couple? And oftentimes the couple will have to determine that, and they may say, well, that doesn't make sense for us. I don't want my wife to be subordinate and touch my feet and do anything I say without disagreeing if she has a disagreement. But the principle is women are protected by men. Men are sexually controlled. Women are sexually controlled. They're devoted to their families, to their husbands. They understand the male ego wants to dominate. They allow him that privilege to be in control. And that in intermingling of men and women in society, there's sufficient separation so men and women will not end up having any kind of illicit connection, which just becomes totally destructive for the family. Now, if you extend that idea, you extend it into the world of, let's say, I can speak from the point of view of a man, you extend that idea. So now if a man is a brahmacharya vanaprastha sannyas, he has very little connection with women, and certainly he should not be going to movies and seeing scenes of women embracing men. But even as married men or women, we should be removed from that as far as possible, because those things stimulate sexual tendencies, and a lot of those sexual tendencies that they stimulate are illicit sexual tendencies, not for sexual tendencies for one's spouse, but for others. Because that is so common in our society. You interview a famous person, yeah, well, you know, I have a relationship with my wife, but I also have a relationship with a girlfriend, and my wife and the girlfriend are friends, and we're working it out. You know, things like that are common. Well, you know, I was straight, then I decided I would go gay, and then that worked for a while, and I left my husband, and I, yeah, and that worked, and then I decided, well, that's not working anymore, so I went back with my husband. And, you know, you'll hear things like this from the celebrities. And, you know, we're just surrounded by them. We're surrounded by pictures of half-naked women and advertisements. And so for us as devotees, we want to be able to see through all that stuff and go, oh, look what's going on here. Look at the message that's going on in this ad, in this TV show, in this story, in this magazine article. All these sexual messages are undermining the foundations of chastity and sexual control. So I think that's really the essential point for us. So Kirtan is asking, do men in Vedic culture have to take sannyas before they die? Only men of the higher castes, not the Shudras, are never allowed to take sannyas. And how would we apply that for ourselves? Generally, we would say if we think it's beneficial later in life to do that, then do it. But, you know, you may do it and you may just fall on your face. Even you're 80 years old, you may not be ready for it. But the principle is renunciation. At some point when the kids grow up, you start winding down and no, you know, you're not expanding your household anymore. Gradually you're retiring or you've retired and you're just focusing on your spiritual life. So that's what you're supposed to do at the end. If you can take sannyas, if that will be the best thing, you can actually do it, yes. That's the ideal. Radhakrishna Devadasi says, I was raised with this culture and these rules and regs, however, they were not met, and unfortunately this is something I've witnessed many times even in our Krishna conscious society. In other words, you're raised in this culture, but you don't see it. You're told one thing, but you grow up seeing something else, and what you see has more influence on you than what you're told. So how do we work with this, and how do we move forward from this and change it? Like you said, this is a touchy topic. I think we need to understand it and then see if we can be examples of it ourselves. It's really important to understand, you know, okay, I'm a man and you're a woman. So as a man, what is my role towards my wife? What is my role, if any, what is my role in general towards women? How do I behave with women in general? How do I behave with my wife? How do I not behave with women in general? How do I not behave with my wife? How do I behave with other men? It's interesting that Lord Chaitanya quoted a verse and he said that for a man to intimately associate with a woman other than his wife is like poison. And it's better that he drinks poison than intimately associates with a woman, because then he'll fall down and he'll lose his Krishna consciousness. It's better he kills himself first. But in that verse it says, but even worse than associating intimately with a woman is to associate with men who are attached to women, because that will disturb a man's mind even more. So when I'm saying, well, what is my duty as a man? Well, my duty as a man is to be sexually pure. So that means I don't want to intimately associate with any women other than my wife. I don't want to intimately associate with men who are talking about sex or having sex, who are uncontrolled, because that will disturb my mind. Of course, when you go to work, that's that's often who you're hanging out with. So you have to be careful. In the workplace, I have to be careful about intimately associating with women. As a woman, the same thing. You want to be chaste to your husband. If you're not married, you want to understand that if there's any man in my life, I'm not going to be thinking about this man in any kind of serious relationship unless this man has potentially the qualifications to be my husband. That's how a woman would think. And if a man's not married, that's how he thinks. He doesn't just think every woman is an object of my enjoyment. But if there's going to be a serious relationship, it's, is this woman material to be a wife. It's not just, I'm just going to go out and have fun with women. So those are basic principles. Now, how they form within our culture and how people who've come from a culture which is sexually crazed, or from a generation like the 60s, which is sexually crazed, and how we adapt to these principles, it's not going to look exactly the same as what we're discussing. But again, if we understand the principle and how to apply it in our life, then even if we don't see it around us, at least we can understand what I have to do. And I would say another thing is understand how difficult it is to do that. And I just want to tell you something. There's a group called Promise Keepers, and these are Christians who take vows of celibacy before marriage. And I think even after marriage, that you can remain a promise keeper, and you just only have sex with your wife. So at one Promise Keepers convention, they did a anonymous ballot. What do you call it, a ballot? What, I forget what you call it. I'm so tired right now. You're lucky I'm even sitting up straight. Survey, that's the word, right? Put some wires back in my head. I went to bed late and got up early. So they asked the men, how many of you have viewed pornography within the last week? It's not the last year, the last week. 50%. These guys are promise keepers, Christians, who are promising celibacy. So our society is so sex-crazed, and this is how we're raised, that we have to, so the Vedic, I would say the Vedic idea is to reduce the sexual fever, to minimize. So everywhere you look, you have to be careful. Victoria's Secret, you're in the mall, you're just some innocent guy walking by. Whew. Victoria, you know, it comes in the mail, the magazine. You know, we have this story of Ajamil. I've been reading this story every morning. It's really wonderful. Ajamil was this pukka, perfect Brahmin boy, you know, really, really first class. And he's out one day, and there's this couple, and they're practically naked, practically having sex. And he sees it, and it just totally disturbs his mind. And seeing it, he wants to do it. You know, he just went from this high level of a Brahmin, and he became totally agitated. And he eventually found a prostitute and gave up his wife and went and live with the prostitute. So that's what we're dealing with. That potential is always there because there's such intimate mingling of men and women and so much opportunity for illicit connection with women, prostitution, pornography, all these things. So Bhakti and Carol reminded me that I missed her question. So we're going to go back. And Kirtan wants me to explain her last question. But let's answer Bhakti and Carol first. So Bhakti and Carol is asking, how much is this lifestyle practiced now in India? More so in the villages, less so in the cities, and less so amongst the younger generation? I was staying with an elderly couple years ago in India, maybe 10 years ago. And so, you know, I was interested in how they got married and their whole life. And she was an initiated devotee and he wasn't. He wasn't that interested in Krishna consciousness. You know, so I was, you know, Western couple, it would be really difficult for us to do that. You know, you're really into Krishna consciousness and your spouse is not really into it. It would be hard. So, you know, I was asking her about that. And she said, in our culture, at least the cultures that the time she grew up in our culture, there's no divorce. So she was kind of saying, well, not kind of saying, but she told me, she said, yeah, we fight. I said, but we never think of divorce. It's just, it doesn't exist within our culture. It's not an option. So in our culture now, it's a big option. And it's such a big option that a lot of people will live together and not get married, just so it's easier to get out. So, you know, traditional culture, because they grew up with this idea that once you're married, marriage is a dharma, and once you're married, you stay together. somehow or other they could deal with differences and incompatibilities. They weren't, I don't think they were looking for the same things that we look for today in a marriage. Because our society today, we are so focused on me and me being happy and me enjoying. So we enter this marriage and it's all about, I want to be happy. I want this guy to make me happy. I want this woman to make me happy. And then if the woman or the guy doesn't make us happy, then we have a difficult time with it. Whereas in traditional culture in India, you know, it was an ashram. So, you know, just like when a man takes sannyas, he's not thinking, wow, I'm going to have a really good time. I'm really going to enjoy. But he's thinking, I'm going to make spiritual advancement. And he understands that there's austerities involved in taking sannyas. So grihastha, it's an ashram, which is meant for purification. So when it's entered that way, we relate to it differently. So it's more that way within traditional Indian societies, and perhaps maybe more so in South India, more traditional. But this, the modern generation growing up in India now in the cities, they've been all exposed to the same media that we are exposed to in the West, and the same messages are, you know, all these messages are coming to them, so they're becoming like us. So it'll become more and more common for people to live together and not be married. Divorce will become more common. And I don't know if you've heard this story or heard this example, but it's a really apropos example. That if you put a frog in hot water, it'll jump out. But if you put a frog in cold water and gradually warm it up, you can get to the boiling point and it won't jump out, and it'll stay in there and it'll die. So society becomes degraded little by little. We don't really notice how degraded it's becoming. So that's what's happened in the world. If you look at any pictures of people at the beach from the turn of the 1900s, they were fully clothed. That was just normal. So gradually, you know, little clothes came off, little, you know, so practically now there's nothing. And that's, so now people don't think anything of it. It's just normal. So, you know, it's normal to have kids out of wedlock. It's, you know, just all these things are normal. It's normal to have sex as a teenager. Most teenage boys view pornography. It's just normal. So our point of view, we have to look at maintaining sexual purity, because the whole idea in Vedic society was to reduce the sexual fever. So now we have to go back. Do men? So Kirtan's asking, can I answer his question a little more? Do men in Vedic culture have to take sannyas before they die? So, and then, what did he say? Can I say something more about it? Can I answer it again? Definitely shudras don't take sannyas, they're not qualified. So now if we're asking, did you find like great kings always renounced? You know, you have that in the Bhagavatam, and Brahmins always renounced. But I think for us, okay, that's the ideal. At a certain point in life, we should take sannyas. But at the same time, if you're not qualified, what's the point? The point is to become qualified. But if you're not, at least some form of renunciation, even if you stay with your wife. That's the idea. That, you know, Vedic culture is meant to leave us to renunciation. And as you can see, when people get old, they generally tend to become naturally renounced. They've lived a full life. They've had whatever they wanted. They give things away to their kids, their grandkids. They might sell the house, get a smaller place, get an apartment. So it's natural to renounce. And then in India, going to places of pilgrimage, people go to places of pilgrimage all their life. So maybe when they're older, there's more of an inclination to spend more time in places of pilgrimage and do puja. At least that's the idea that Prabhupada wants to instill within us. That at a certain point in your life, our lives are so busy maintaining families and so forth, but life is meant for Krishna consciousness. So we don't want to go our whole life just busy, 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 busy. But at the end, at some point, we just have to stop and go, okay, that's enough. I'm ending this business and now fully devoted to Krishna consciousness. That's the idea. So it said, you know, after 50, don't have any children, so you can start winding down. That's the idea. So, Radhika's going, I think, going somewhere. Okay. So what are the deal breakers in a marriage in Vedic culture? Well, you know, in the Prabhupada tells the story about his sister. His sister's husband was a drunkard, and she stayed with him. And he said, because she stayed with him, he became purified by that. So that's, you know, that's one angle of it. In the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada said, if you're a devotee and your husband is breaking the principles of Krishna consciousness, you're not obliged to remain with him. So you could say the deal breaker is any time he breaks a principle. Now, what if your husband physically harms you or rapes you? In Vedic culture, these things, you know, if you have a good husband, he wouldn't do that. So I would say, from the woman's perspective, I would say if she has any question about whether this or that is a deal breaker, she should take counsel. Because sometimes it could be that she's causing her husband to act in a certain way, or it could be that her husband is incorrigible and she's wasting her time trying to improve the situation. So it's really a one-to-one basis. It's not like if your husband cheats on you or your wife cheats on you, that's it, that you have to divorce them. You can forgive them. You can go on. I think generally, you know, Prabhupada's attitude was always to forgive and rectify. But if one can't forgive or doesn't want to forgive, that's their prerogative. And sometimes if a woman cheats a husband, if a man cheats on his wife, sometimes the wife can't forgive, and the men have to accept that. The woman may not be able to forgive that. May go against everything she believes to be right, and she just can't stand living with a man who's done that. That may be there. Or she may be able to forgive. So I would say first, I would try to forgive and rectify, if possible. I'm giving a lot of ambiguous answers because Prabhupada is not totally cut and dry on these issues. And we're dealing with two individuals, and each group of individuals, each couple is different, and they have different objectives in life, and they're different levels of Krishna consciousness. And they themselves ultimately will have to decide how they want to work it out. You know, Prabhupada, you know, when questions were asked to Prabhupada that didn't have really black and white answers, he often would say, do what's best for your Krishna consciousness. So that's a general answer. You know, in other words, we're here in this body, and the goal of our lives is to be Krishna conscious. So we always want to evaluate every situation and the decisions we make regarding those situations ultimately on what is going to be best for my Krishna consciousness. That's the ultimate thing. It may be best thing to stay with a husband who's not following principles. It may be the best thing not to. You know, it's not always black and white. It's not always clear. Bhaktin Carol says, I recently read a nice article about important figures, heroes in our cultures. In India, there's Lord Ram. For the Western world, there's Romeo, who defies culture, family, and is implanted as hero. Yeah, so we have these nice examples in Vedic literature. You know, we have these examples of these very devout, controlled men and very devout, controlled, chaste wives. And that's where we're supposed to get our inspiration. And as I was saying, within the culture we live in, what do they call the culture we live in? There's a word for it. The native culture. What is it? Udava, you know, sometimes what they say. You know, the host culture. Yeah. We're the culture we live in, we call it the host culture. You know, I live in America, so that's the host culture. If you live in India, that's the host culture. So the culture, so Krishna consciousness is a different culture from the host culture we live in. So we need our, you know, in the host culture, you'll get all the wrong messages. And they create all kinds of impressions. And if we just become a little sensitive, we'll see how they're creating impressions. It's amazing if you really open yourself up to it and see all the sexual impressions that are being fed to us. You start seeing subtleties of them that you didn't notice. You will no longer take for granted all the sexual messages, visual and audio, that are coming to you or in print. It's just like I'm preparing a class on sexual purity, so I'm very, very aware of these things. And I was traveling this week, and I was in a hotel, and I was just looking at a magazine, local magazine. And on the cover, beautiful women, the next page, liquor, the next page, liquor, the next page, liquor, next page, beautiful woman, next page, a restaurant, steakhouse, you know. And just so you look at it all and say, okay, well, what does this all amount to? It all amounts to sex, sexual energy. And particularly for us, just disturbing our minds. Then I was listening to an interview with some famous person who said, yeah, I was married, it didn't work out, and I decided, you know, I'll try to be gay and see how that works out. And so, you know, she's being interviewed, and the person interviewing her was like, oh, yeah, that's cool, how did that work out? You know, just discussing it like, it's just a normal thing, you know, just like, you know, try it, you know. You're not getting along with your husband, you know, find some lady and see if that works, you know. So the tone of the conversation was like, yeah, well, this is just like, you're just exploring and, you know, whatever. So if you look at it, you know, you really look into what's coming at us in society, all this polluting stuff is coming to us like it's just normal. It's just like, yeah, half-naked women all over the covers of magazines. Well, that's just normal. And we think we're immune to it, but we're not. And then when a husband is found cheating on his wife, you say, well, you wonder why. You know, look at all the sexual stimulus he's getting. I want to tell you a really funny story. And even if you don't take my class in sexual purity, you get to hear this. This is a nice story. So there are two teenage boys watching television in the living room, and the father walks through. And while he's walking through, he's looking at the television. What does he see? Lo and behold, there's a graphic sexual scene in the movie. And he's thinking, this is not what my kids should be watching. So he says, hey guys, what's going on here? You know, what movie are you watching? And they said, oh, Dad, don't worry. There's not many sexual scenes in it. The father's thinking, don't worry. There's not many sexual scenes. So the father thinks, okay, I'm going to teach them a lesson. So, you know, the kids are saying, well, you know, there's not much. Don't worry, Dad, there's not much. What's going on here? Oh, there's not much sex. The father comes in with some brownies and some milk. And they go, hey, thanks, Dad. And they start eating the brownies, and they say, hey, Dad, these brownies, they don't taste like Mom's. Did you follow the recipe? He goes, yeah, I followed the recipe. He said, but I just added a little bit of something else. Not much, just a little bit of something else. He goes, well, what did you add? Because these don't taste good. There's something wrong with them. And he said, well, I went in the backyard and got some dog poop, and I added them to the brownies, but I didn't add much. So, Prabhu, I don't watch much, you know, romantic movies, you know, with sex. Not much. Just a little. Not much. Oh, okay. So, if that's your philosophy, put a little dog poop in your prasadam. Just don't put too much in, because, you know, if it's not much, it won't matter, right? It all matters. That's the problem. The problem is we don't think it matters. It all matters. We're digesting it, and it stinks. Okay. So we need the proper heroes, the examples, the Haridas Thakurs, who, I love Thakur Haridas. Maya came, her first, a beautiful prostitute came, you know. You imagine how beautiful she was, you know. You want to get the best to try to allure him, because he's it would be the most difficult. So you can imagine, you know, and he's just such a hero that he's so chaste, devoted. And then Maya herself comes, can't budge him. These are our heroes. You know, the chastity of Sita. And the dedication of Ram to protect Sita, all these things. So important for us, because that's the... We are living in a host culture, but we're trying to adopt the principles of another culture. So we really have to live more within that culture. And Indian families, when they come to the West, that's their conclusion. If they don't live within their culture, their kids are going to be total Americans, and they're going to be divorced from all the good things that their culture has. And they're going to succumb to the bad things in Western culture. It's particularly the sexual energy, which is, you know, creating, you know, what's all this divorce coming from? Just this sexual energy that's uncontrolled. Yash says, is there sex where Lord Krishna lives? Sorry, not quite. No, it's not like sex here. The Prabhupada says that, you know, Krishna, he has his gopis and they dance. The gopis leave home and they go with Krishna and dance. But Prabhupada said, you'll never see they're pregnant. That's sex is a perversion of real love. So ultimately, sex in the material world is really a punishment, because it's what keeps us attached here. And it's very difficult for people to understand this. And I think ultimately you can only understand it by not having sex. As because if you're having it, you're biased to it, and you see it as a form of pleasure and enjoyment, and you can't understand why God would ever want to deprive you of that pleasure. And that's why the Christians, although they strongly advocate celibacy, chastity, continence before marriage, in marriage they advocate enjoying sex unlimitedly, basically. That's their philosophy. Because they believe it's such a great pleasure that God has given to you to enjoy. But we see it as a cause of material entanglement, identification with the body. So Krishna's sexual enjoyment has nothing to do with the kind of sexual enjoyment we have. What we're enjoying is perverted. Now, it's interesting to note, at least from the male perspective, that semen strengthens the body and the mind. And it's said that brahmacharis have perfect memory because they never lose semen. And I was reading a book on brahmacharya, and it said when a man loses semen, when it's lost, it can't be replaced. It damages him physically and mentally, and it's irreparable damage. So what is damaging to the body physically and spirit and mentally, and also damaging spiritually, is considered the greatest pleasure in the material world. So much so that if you get old and you lose the desire to have sex, they have pills for you, so you can keep doing it. There is a magazine I get from this herbalist called Dr. Schultz. So it has all these herbal remedies. And in one page, it's got all these men with their heads in their hands like this. And they're all lamenting. Guess why they're lamenting? Anybody can guess why they're lamenting? They're older men, 60, 70, they're lamenting. Why are they lamenting? Because they've lost their libido. They've lost their desire to enjoy sex. They don't have the sexual power. Now, if those men were devotees, that page would be like this. Haribo, I'm liberated. Wouldn't it? Finally, I've become free. There's a story. Prabhupada was once up late at night, like midnight, and his secretary was still up. And he said, oh, Prabhupada, you're awake. And then Prabhupada said, yes, I can't sleep. And Prabhupada was ill at that time. He said, I can't eat. And he said, there's no question of sex. And there's no question of defending, nothing to defend. He said, and Prabhupada said, I guess I'm liberated. And then he went on and he said, I was always hoping and praying. I was always praying to Krishna that I could be free from the need to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. So that's the attitude of a devotee. His ultimate ecstasy is to become free from the desire to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. Of course, for materialists, his desire is to go on eating, sleeping, mating, and defending eternally. So finally, nature takes its course, and your sex desire is reduced. Hello, guess why? You're a little bit too old to have kids. You know, so nature has taken that away. So your brain can work a little better. You know, when you're crazed with sex desire, your brain, like, malfunctions. And you get things, like, really mixed up. So you're older now. That desire is subsiding. So you can, like, think, like, maybe there's something more than sex. Maybe life has a higher purpose than just having sex and eating and sleeping. But they don't get it. They call up their doctor and go, Viagra, I need Viagra. I'm dying here. I need Viagra. There's no, I can't live. There was once there's a movie theater a couple blocks from the LA Temple, and Prabhupada was taking a walk, or some devotees told him about the movie. And the title of the movie was, Is There Sex After Death? So Prabhupada commented and he said, yes, you can tell them there is sex after death. So what did Prabhupada say? If you want to have sex like a pigeon, you'll become a pigeon. Yeah, there'll be sex after death in some body or another. So that's the principle of Vedic culture, to control that. So we want heroes like Takahari Das, who are totally controlled. Radhakrishna Devi is saying, that actually sounds pretty black and white. What is best for our Krishna consciousness, I mean? I have to go back to what the black and white was. I think the problem is that we have to look at each situation individually. You mean the black and white is what's best for our Krishna consciousness? Well, also what's best for our Krishna consciousness is usually what's best for our material sanity, because we're not materially, if we're not situated properly materially, then it's really hard to practice our Krishna consciousness. So in determining, you know, I guess we're going back to what are the deal breakers. We want to determine, well, what's will be the most stable situation for us materially, so that we can execute our bhakti. But as I was saying, it also depends on the culture we come from, because I think in some cultures where you're trained to see marriage as a deep, or for particularly for a woman, to see that to honor and serve your husband is like the highest service. You know, that's how in Vedic culture, that's how a woman saw her duty as a wife. That was, you know, her husband was her god, and that was the highest service. So if you come from that paradigm, then naturally you're going to be able to tolerate a lot of mischief on your husband's part. But if you don't come from that paradigm, you may not be able to tolerate it, and so then you have to deal with it according to what will keep you peaceful and stable, and thereby will help you execute Krishna consciousness. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive when I say, well, do what's best for your Krishna consciousness. Well, you'll have to do what's best materially also, because that, if it's not, it can be disturbing to your Krishna consciousness. So, I hope that makes sense. But if you want to, if any of you want to email me with practical questions, if it's practical, like, this is the situation I'm in and how to deal with it, then that will be easier for me to talk about it, because we're speaking general here, and it may not always be possible to address the situation in a way that applies to you exactly. Or it may not be the situation you're in, it may be you know, what your upbringing is, and then how to deal with that in relation to the situation. So we'd want to look at one or both of those things. And as I said, the benefits of celibacy. As I said, you know, this is a difficult subject, and I'm not saying that I have all the answers, but I just want to open it up for more discussion. Shivananda of Divine Life Mission, Shivananda Swami of Divine Life Mission, has written a book on celibacy. You can find some things about it, but I think it's very helpful. Yeah. When I came in here, Bhakti Greg says, I look tired. When I came in, the first thing I told Uddhava said is, I roll out the bed, I'm ready to go to sleep. Yeah, I went to bed at midnight last night and got up early. But at least I made it through an hour. All I have to do is drive home now. So, Jivananda Swami, great article on celibacy. And you read a lot about what Prabhupada talks about in relation to men and women and sexuality. And, you really see the theme coming out of how we have to preserve sexual control. That's really the essence of any civilized society. And if you look at societies when they fall, why do they fall? Because they become degraded morally. Look at the Roman society. They went head over heels in sexual immorality. And so, I said, I look at America and I think, how's America going to make it? People are becoming so degraded. So I'm going to take Bhakti Greg's advice and go to sleep. He says I look bushed. I'm beyond bushed. So thank you, everyone. And if you want to email me, please do. And come back next week. If you have other questions, think of them this week. And Bhakti and Carol says, we don't need to mindlessly watch TV. If you watch TV, you're going to see sex in some way or a form. And it's going to affect you consciously, unconsciously. So just be aware of it. Okay? Hare Krishna.